Hello and welcome back to Fitness Unfiltered with me, Emma Story Gordon, and Dan. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Mike, how are you?
I am fine.
And today we have a very special guest, Luke Hoffman. How are you?
I am also fine, thank you.
Oh, great. Okay, so we wanted Luke on today for numerous reasons, but primarily to talk about two things. The importance of biomechanics for everyone, just briefly. And secondly, and this is the discussion we were having, is training to failure. Do we need to do it? What are the benefits? And who are those benefits most for? So I thought I would start with generally the benefits or the requirement to understand some level of biomechanics for personal trainers.
Is this just an open floor?
This is now you. Go.
All is yours.
Pressure. That's a blindside because I was like, in my head, I've been prepping. I was like, okay, points to bring up around training to failure.
We are going to talk a lot about training to failure, but I thought this was interesting because we were speaking at Level Up and I was like, I don't know if I buy that much into like, I think I had a false perception of the way that you teach biomechanics. And I thought, oh, it's overcomplicating things and it's putting barriers up to people to exercise. But I was completely wrong. And I thought maybe you could share that with the podcast listeners.
I don't believe it. It must have been a success if we persuaded Emma.
Yeah. Firstly,
thank you for having me on. An honor to be back. That is the question. Why should we understand biomechanics or exercise mechanics as exercise professionals? There we go. my view, and I think the argument I proposed on the James and I proposed on that weekend, which was awesome, by the way. Was, you know, as exercise professionals, and I'll try not to make this too long. Our jobs largely revolve around applying forces to people's anatomy for a living. That's what exercise is. If you look at exercise in any of its forms, whether it's body weight, you know, calisthenic stuff, whether it's CrossFit, whether it's powerlifting, you know, these are all kind of disciplines. But whether you're training it for bodybuilding purposes and, you know, resistance, you know, so it's resistance training, running, walking, you know, all these sorts of things are instances where force is being applied to anatomy, usually with a specific intention and hopefully appropriately. And that's where, you know, exercise means many different things to people and they've got and what they many goals they might have and all this sort of stuff. But fundamentally it will boil down to we're applying a force to someone's body, you know, and the body's made up of these, you know, bones and joints and all these sorts of things, which fundamentally work as lever systems. Which is where in the qualification process for becoming a level 3 PT, they do briefly touch on lever systems and stuff, but they never really tell you why it's actually useful. And it's largely because, you know, everything we do in the context of training, you know, is involving moving our limbs, you know, which involves rotation at joints and all this sort of stuff. And this all sounds super complicated, which is where I think a lot of people get alienated. And they're like, you know, and also when you take exercise as a concept, as a thing, that most of us have encountered and experienced in a very intuitive sense. You know, we've learned how to do it through just doing it and feeling stuff and listening to other people. And then someone comes along and goes, it's really just physics, you know, so we can look at it with numbers and lines on 2D images and stuff. And people be like, oh, that sounds like you're overcomplicating it. And it can do because, and you know, when some of the ways it has been taught, and I know when we first started out, definitely went in to, you know, and I say we, when I was with my previous crew at the Muscle Mentors, you know, we probably definitely, can't use those words together. We definitely went in too advanced, too quickly with some people. And I think some people came away from some of the early stuff we did and they were like, whoa, you know, that was a bit much.
I guess like something that I know that we got a lot of feedback about from Level Up was understanding like personal biomechanics and knowing that, you know, a lot of people think that there's this perfect form for this exercise, like a squat's a great example, right? But if you have different lengths of like thighs or different ways that your back moves, or yeah, basically a different length of spine in comparison to your legs and things, like your squat will look slightly different than someone else's squat, but that doesn't mean that it's right or that it's wrong, but it's right for you. And I think that understanding is quite freeing to a lot of people, because like, oh, that's never felt right to me. So from a personal level, it could be everyone's always told me to squat in this way and it's never felt right for me. And it's like, okay, well, you don't need to squat in that way. Like you need to squat in the way that's right for you, given your like dynamic, your
mechanics, basically.
Your mechanics, essentially. Yeah. And then also knowing that from a personal training standpoint, like you don't want to be forcing everyone into the exact same movement patterns because they aren't right for everyone.
Yeah. Oh, Dan.
No, I was just going to say, because I just wanted to interject there and just say that, because I find that really interesting often when you see these critiques of range of motion, but it's relative range of motion. So that individual with exactly as you said, like different lever lengths, different constructs, like everyone's built differently. We can't expect an exact replica in terms of textbook exercises, which can you account for that through qualification? I don't think you can, but perhaps they don't address the individuality enough.
No, I mean, that, and that's one of the things, you know, when people have done RTS, Resistance Training Specialist is a program that was founded by Tom Purvis, who is the OG of exercise mechanics. And it's taught in the UK by a Mr. Michael Goulden in London. And it's easily one of the best courses you'll ever do as an exercise professional. It's one of the courses that I and many others who've done it a few times. I've done it like five times. It's one of those ones that you just can keep going back. And you're exploring stuff in person, but you'll come out of it the first time probably a bit kind of like, well, that was quite overwhelming, because you just had all your beliefs around exercise challenged and you're like, what have I been doing? But you also will probably come out of it and go, why isn't this what everyone's taught when they're qualifying? Because this seems to be the actual way that you make what we do in the gym with clients personal, which is largely why it's worth, so coming full circle to that question, why is it worth understanding exercise mechanics? Because if we're going to call ourselves personal trainers and our job is to prescribe exercise, and apply forces to people's anatomy, we want to understand what we're doing, and we want to be able to make it personal. We want to be able to put someone in an exercise, whether it's a machine, whether it's with a barbell, whatever it is, and know that actually this is appropriate for this person based on how they're built, their limitations, their skill level, their goals, you know, what are they actually trying to achieve. How many people are told, you know, I've in the first gym I ever properly PT'd in, I'm going to take shots at the guys that worked in there at the time, it was full of Olympic lifters, and there'd be a lot of people, like the trainers were all Olympic lifters, and the gym kind of revolved around that. And there's a lot of people coming in and they were like, I want to get in shape. And these guys were like, cool, Olympic lifting. We're going to do snatches and we're going to teach you how to clean and jerk. And then a lot of these people, and you see them never experienced that stuff, looking like Bambi on ice, they have no skill, no coordination. But that was all these guys knew, and they had the bias that were like, Olympic lifting's great. It's a great strength tool. It's great for coordination. It's great for skill, you know, all these sort of things. And you're like, but that isn't relevant to that individual. And have you actually asked them what their goals are? Have you taken into account, do they have the range of motion available to get into these positions and, you know, safely and you know, even when people are like, I want to get in shape, you're like, well, actually, do we even need to touch a barbell, maybe? Okay, if it's okay. Yeah,
I mean, you definitely wouldn't spend, like, I've seen people do this as well, and I, like, spend potentially hours and hours and sessions perfecting full range squat technique when someone wants to come in and lose some body fat. Like, that's probably not why they're there. That's probably not what they care about, and that actually they might not ever need to squat.
Yeah, and it's, actually, I had a really good conversation with a guy at Level Up. And we were in after the talk, and he came up and asked, and you know, we got onto the topic of strength, And, you know, because there's so many conversations that we could have around, you know, with our clients around some of the things that, you know, their goals and, you know, what we do as exercise specialists, what we help them with. And he mentioned he works a lot with strength, or he's been working on his strength and stuff like that. And he deals with a lot of clients that have that sort of goal, seemingly. And I said to him, okay, well, you know, what's your interpretation of strength? And he was like, you know, working with like low reps, maybe max 5 reps, heavy weight. So we're trying to recruit as much, you know, muscle, as much motor, as many motor units as possible and stuff like that. And I was like, interesting. I was like, what, you know, is that the interpretation that your clients have when they say they want to get stronger? And he was like, I don't know. And I was like, have you asked them? You know, when they said, I want to get stronger. Because stronger to someone else might mean I want to be able to sit down and stand up properly because I'm nearly 70 and it's becoming quite tricky. Or it might be I want to be able to go and play in the garden with my kids without kind of feeling weak and not able to get, you know, do stuff with them and so they can have fun. And it might be I want to be really specific about getting stronger at squatting if their goal is something related to powerlifting. But it, yeah, there's all these different interpretations that we could have of it. And he was like, oh God, he's like, that's a good point. So they're like, you know, when we have those sorts of things come up and client comes in and says, I want to get in shape, you know, why do they want to get in shape? What does it mean to them? But again, in the strength thing, you know, if someone's like, I want to feel stronger, maybe it's a personal thing, maybe it's their confidence, maybe they want to be stronger character, all these sorts of things, you know, there's no tool that we have to use in the gym to achieve that outcome is basically what I'm getting at here. So it doesn't mean someone said strength, we need to do the strength conditioning part of my qualification that taught me that I should get everyone to use a barbell. Like, that so then, true.
Like to play devil's advocate a little bit, and I think I probably know what the answer to this is going to be, but I would like to ask it for the benefit of the listeners. If it's so individual and biomechanics are so individual and goals are so individual, then is a certain amount of it just intuitive anyway? Like, do we need to, like, especially, I guess my question is twofold. A, I suppose the answer is obvious. Personal trainers perhaps do need to learn more about it. But do you think clients need to learn more about it? Or do you think that, let's say, for example, if a personal trainer does like a movement assessment with a client and just focuses on the movements that they tend to do quite naturally and not the movements that they have to be coached into trying to get perfect, then that's all they really need to do? Or do you think that personal trainers need to learn more about it? And do you think the actual people doing the exercise need to know about it? Or do you think that their bodies will tell them the answers?
I mean, it's difficult in terms of do the people doing the exercises need to know about it? I think the trainers should. I think if you're going to call yourself an exercise professional, you should know the tools you have available. And that's basically like, I can go into, you know, can you go into a gym and know when you do this exercise, this is the force that you're applying to them and this is the potential outcome? Do we need to geek out on it with the clients to that level? Is if that's kind of where you're getting at in terms of explain exactly what's going on and all that sort of stuff? I would say no. And I would, you know, definitely bear in mind that sort of stuff that you just mentioned of what's relevant to them as an individual, based on what they need and what their current skill level is and what they want to do potentially. But there's that line that originated in RTS. I don't know if it originated in RTS. I'm pretty sure it did. Think science, speak client. So none of this stuff we talk about when, you know, someone goes and studies mechanics, they don't need to ever bring that up with a client. The point of studying it is so that they know when they put together a program or they pick an exercise for a client, they're like, I'm confident this is relevant to this person's goal, what they have available in terms of a skill level, in terms of joint range of motion, strength, all this sort of stuff, what they can own in terms of confidence and their ability to do stuff, what they can tolerate in terms of force, you know, and kind of stimulus in general, you know, those sorts of things. So I don't know if that's answered the question.
Yeah, no, I think it has. Sort of speaking as a client, I think there is this, like, there's this sort of overwhelming amount of information and stuff like on Instagram and things like that. It's tough to know when people are talking to other personal trainers and when people are talking to clients, and then I start overthinking movements that I'm doing, and I'm sort of saying to my coach, why aren't we doing this like this? Because so-and-so says that if you add this to this, then it would be better for like recruitment of your inferior fibers or whatever. And I might be reminded by my coach that we're not that worried about my inferior fibers or whatever, because my goals are different. But I think like there is kind of this, thirst for minutiae, isn't there, like to find the the hidden secrets and the perfect way of doing everything. There's sometimes I think people don't see the wood for the trees, and I suppose that's what I'm sort of asking and wanting to differentiate with, is that actually there is a difference between learning this stuff as a professional and learning it as somebody who is just wanting to exercise, like to self, to learn it to apply to other people is different to learning it to apply to yourself, right?
Yeah. But I think you nailed it when you said it kind of comes down to the goals of the person, like, and also their interpretation of things, because even the bodybuilder that wants to be super specific about developing body part, like there's certain things that the mechanics realm have gone so deep into and maybe been too reductionist with in some of the claims they make, in terms of, this exercise is best done for this particular fiber, these fibers of this muscle, and you have to do it with this arm path and all this sort of thing. You're like, that isn't largely the case most of the time. There was actually a good meme I saw where, I think it was today actually, someone put a meme, it was like what trainers or bodybuilders think an exercise is doing for their muscle, and it was like a picture of a sniper. Or how they think it's targeting it, and it was like the reality of how that exercise is targeting your muscles, and it was like a spray can, it's like it's spraying this kind of area. No, we can never be really specific, but back to the point about working with the client, like we can get lost seriously in kind of trying to make things really 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 exact, and it can take away from the experience massively for someone who's just like, coming back to that point ever made, I just want to get in shape. Why the fuck am I having to do a rear delt, cable fly with it? I've got a cuff here and I've got to make sure that it's dropping off by 20% as I get into the end range. It's like, we don't need to do that. And that's where, the reality of, I mentioned it in Level Up, one of the freedoms we have as exercise professionals is to, prescribe and also create exercises. We can come up with something that suits an individual, and we might base that off sensation. We might base that off the fact that they can't get their arm into a certain position. We need to adapt something to them, whatever it is. But every exercise is made up. Some guy decided back in the day that squatting with a barbell on your back was a really good idea. And that became this thing that everyone was like, oh my God, if I do a squat, I should have a barbell on my back. It was like, well, there's loads of ways you could do that. Yeah. And when you kind of look at stuff and you look at what we do and you're thinking, actually, every exercise is just made up at some point. Some of them have just survived the test of time because they're easily applicable. People can do them. They're applicable. They're available, these sorts of things. But that doesn't mean we have to exactly to that all the time. And we can play around with that, again, based on the individual. And no exercise is good or bad, because ultimately, the line we use is, there's no such thing as good or bad exercise. It's just we should understand what an exercise offers us and then base that on the individual. Okay, sweet. We know a dumbbell lateral raise gets heavier and heavier as you raise the dumbbell out to the side. So that has a particular way of applying force to the shoulder. For some people, that might be great. For other people, you might be like, we can get more creative with that. Maybe we'll bring a cable in.
It comes back to, I think, to absolutism again, doesn't it? We've spoken about that about a lot of different topics, but I think it goes wrong when people are like, you can't get anything out of this exercise if you don't do X, or you have to do this, have to do this or it's pointless, or this exercise is completely pointless. It is interesting that people just want to have those definite answers, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, my experience with studying mechanics has been, the more I've studied it, the more I've come back round to being like, actually, there's a time and a place for pretty much every exercise, really. You can do whatever you want, and ultimately, as long as you understand what you're doing, and you think and it's appropriate for you or whoever you're doing it to, sweet, crack on. You know,
there are, I also think like one of the amazing things about exercise, and like I want to hammer this home because anyone listening might be a little bit like, fuck, I don't know exactly why I'm doing X, Y, or Z. From a client or a personal trainer perspective, like if you are doing any exercise safely, that is good. Like there are incredible benefits to every kind of exercise. Like you don't actually need to be doing it exactly in the right way to get the benefits. And I think that there is, like talking more from my client base, this fear of going into the gym and doing the wrong thing, or I don't want to start exercise because I don't know where to start and it seems really complicated. And then like this kind of level does add to that complication of, well, no, I don't know what forces are going through my body in this direction. And I don't know what pressures are under my, like are on my muscles when I do this exercise versus this exercise. And then you can quite quickly get into, well, I have no idea where to start, so I'm just not going to go. Whereas realistically, if you are new to exercise and you go into the gym and you go, I'm going to do two lower body exercises on machines because they seem safe and I feel quite comfortable with them, and two upper body exercises on machines because they seem, you know, like I know roughly what I'm doing. I'm going to do three sets of 10. I'm going to push myself quite hard and go in and do that three times a week. You'll get really good results.
Yeah. And then you could top that off by being like, and I'm going to do a barbell squat on a Bosu ball, because even though loads of people have said it's dangerous and it's rubbish, I'm going to do it because I really like that exercise. You know, it's that sort of stuff as well. Obviously, we can do it. You need to be safe. But the point there is, you know, if you really enjoy an exercise, if you happen to do, so there was, you know, a friend of mine yesterday did a poster critiquing the T-bar row, you know, when people wedge a barbell in a corner and do a close.
I saw this post.
Yeah, and he'll be fine, Joe Bright. You know, that was it. It was a fair post. It is, yeah. In terms of if we want to be really specific about training muscle on the back, there are better exercises out there than the T-bar row.
Also, doesn't your willy get in the way?
I don't think so.
Whenever I do it,
no, I think it's too late now. But the point there I was getting at would be, the books just fell off the thing. Some people, although that might be an inefficient exercise, some people might love it. I know when I used to do it, I did enjoy it. If you want to get technical and really analyze it, there is some merit potentially for training the back muscles that way, but you have to do it in a specific manner, which is actually coincidentally the way most people do it, which is just kind of quite aggressively like letting that thing drop down really fast and having to stop it. But the point there is exercises we enjoy. If we understand what we're doing, you know, that's largely pretty cool. And I think that's one of the things about mechanics where a lot of the stuff, because it, you know, fundamentally boils down to understanding a little bit about physics is potentially, you know, the physics of what we're doing in the gym is quite useful potentially for, you know, in the same way understanding a little bit about biology and chemistry is quite useful for the nutrition side of stuff.
But you're right, it is about keeping those things in balance, and exercise isn't just about the muscular outcome. It's also about the enjoyment, the sustainability. Like with nutrition, there's lots of different approaches, and some might be less efficient or less useful than others, and some might work better for some people, but actually some might have their merits. I think, again, what is always really difficult is like correlation and causation, and the arguments that people tend to come back with when people criticize like a type of exercise is, oh, well, it worked for Arnold, or, you know, like all of the people in the 70s used to do it and they were absolutely fine. And you know, they all lived to tell the tale and they were all great. And I find it really interesting that people kind of just associate outcomes with what people did. Mm. And assume that what the outcomes were in direct relation to what
genetically elite people, you know, oh, they did this, they were born with incredible calves, and look, they did some calf raises.
Mm.
And I
think I do a hell of a lot technically wrong, but still get results. Like you can do a lot wrong in the gym and still.
But wrong in what sense? Because again, is that wrong according to how people think it should be done, or is that wrong according to how you your body works, because that's, you know, right and wrong ultimately comes down to.
Oh well, like the vast majority of my training is just pull-ups and push-ups.
Yeah, there we go.
So like I wouldn't say that anyone would be like, oh yeah, that's optimal for basically anything unless I wanted to compete in like a pull-up and push-up competition. But like it works for me, it works my life, and like my outcome isn't, I don't want to be a bodybuilder, like I don't care that much. But people might look at my physique and be like, oh, you must, you know, consider all these things, and actually like you can do a lot wrong and still have like what people might see look like quite as symmetrical if you don't look at my lower half of my body physique, right?
It's just, there's a huge amount of not just individual goal, I think it's where people are on their journeys as well, because a huge part of what we do in, you know, when people come to us, it's actually the process of warming people to exercise. So there has to be an element of enjoyment. You know, the whole process towards autonomy is building a certain level of competence. They build that confidence in the gym. They have to feel confident and competent in what they're doing to do it consistently, basically. So it's not that just a short-term fix. So I think exactly the same with aspects of nutrition. And, you know, there's various approaches which, oh, like everyone has to go into tracking macros. But like, if you've never had any experience, your foundational base of knowledge around nutrition is, I see what I like. I think that serves me to a certain level in terms of fueling and nourishing my body. And I eat that. I have no understanding of it, the nutritional density of that. It might be a period of time where you just track, you know, you don't get that individual to do anything else, just to create that hyper awareness around what they consume. And then you've always got the ability to refine that over time. Well, I think we get lost in optimal instead of just thinking about what's realistic for people.
Optimal and practical, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly that.
Right. I am going to move the topic on, because I really want to cover this. Training to failure.
Yeah, well, we can relate it to the same conversation, to be fair.
Yeah, like, is it relevant for everyone? But I think what was quite interesting about the conversation we had is I was like, okay, well, I mean, first of all, why? Maybe we just start with, why would someone train to failure?
Well, I mean, so...
what are the benefits?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. I was thinking, like, what can we agree on straight away? Hopefully. And hopefully we'll agree on most of what we say. I mean, it sounds like we're going to then disagree on a bunch of stuff.
I'm always up for disagreeing with you.
Yeah, I mean, healthy debate's always fun. But the
met Emma?
But no. So in terms of, I'm hoping we can agree straight away that training to failure has been shown to be sufficient for stimulating muscle hypertrophy, but it is not necessary. Would we all agree on that?
We all agree.
So the caveat there being, like, training to failure is probably, well, I would say, according to the research, is definitely necessary if you're using lighter loads and you're wanting to achieve hypertrophy. And that's probably what we should say. Training to failure largely would come up in a conversation around trying to build muscle. So sufficient, but not necessary, in the sense of, if you do it, chances are it will lead to muscle growth, but you don't have to do it.
What I thought was quite interesting from our conversations, I was like, okay, yeah, like, if you're looking to build muscle and you're very motivated to do that, then I absolutely get, like, training to failure, recruiting all those, like, larger motor units, like, see the benefits of all of this. But what was interesting, and actually you brought this up, was there's huge benefits to training to failure for health reasons as well, like in a slightly different context of something like HIIT training, where you're really pushing your body, and we see, like, incredible health benefits to that, which maybe have nothing to do with hypertrophy and actually nothing to do with fat loss either, but you're pushing your body so far out of its, like, comfortable homeostatic range that even with a very short amount of exercise you can get these really important improvements in health markers like VO2 max, like insulin sensitivity. And the reason that that's so useful to gen pop as opposed to, like, people who are already into fitness is because one of the biggest barriers that people put up to exercise is that I don't have time. And yeah, you can argue the whole, you do have time, you just don't prioritize it enough. But that's the truth, okay? Maybe I am saying, I don't prioritize this enough. I don't want to spend my night in the gym. That's fine. But you can't, like, you almost can't argue that when you're like, cool, can you do 10 minutes twice a week. Like, yes, you get, there's no one that's like, no, sorry, couldn't possibly fit it in. Like, this, it's almost like a bit of a compromise, and you will get incredible health benefits from 10 minutes a week. I'm not going to say that that will have like any impact on potentially like building muscle or changing body composition or any significant impacts, but there is the potential to have significant health benefits from a very short amount of exercise. And that does seem to require pushing yourself like to failure.
Mm. Yeah, I would agree. Next point. No, just kidding. No, I would agree in and I'd add to it, like, there's potential benefits for certain individuals, even from a psychological perspective, of, you know, if someone can get to this point where they're comfortable going into a gym on their own or with someone and being pushed or pushing themselves to failure, that can teach people a lot about themselves. You know, if they've never done that before, like, oh my god, look, I've just like gone to the point where I can't lift this thing anymore, that's actually pretty cool. And maybe that will then bleed into other areas of their life where they're dealing with, you know, adversity, and they're like, you know, I've just lifted like this heavy ass weight until I couldn't lift it anymore. I can deal with this work stress, you know, or this relationship stress. Yeah. Going on.
You see that all the time. I think that's one of the huge benefits that like people don't really highlight about exercise, is how much that can translate into other areas of your life. And I think it, like, I remember when I did more face-to-face, like, people don't know, we spoke about this as well, but like how to push themselves to failure. Mm. And there's a very different, like, if you tell an athlete to go to failure, they will literally be on the floor, done. Like, there's nothing more they could possibly do. If you tell your new client who's not really been to the gym before, like, as soon as they start feeling uncomfortable, they'll be like, yeah, this is failure for me. Or what I see all the time is, like, I'll have a client who's like, no, I can't do push-ups. And I'm like, well, let's try them. And then they do like 10 push-ups, and you're like, right, so you can do them. You've just told them you can't, and then you haven't even tried.
Yeah.
So that, and then also just the, like, there's failure, and then there's failure when your personal trainer is pushing you.
Yeah.
Like, I'm feeling personally attacked, by the way, just saying.
Yeah, but that's one of the things people look and often discuss. They discuss failure in the context of resistance training, like it looks the same all the time, and everyone has the same interpretation of it. It's actually one of the biggest problems in research with it as well, is if you actually look at studies on failure, you look at this study over here and they'll define it one way, and then they'll look at this study over here and they define it another way, and then there's this study that define, and you're like, they don't even agree on what failure is. You know, this one says volitional fatigue, this one says momentary muscular failure, this one says until they lost proper form. You're like, what does that mean? So we don't even know, when they're looking at the effects of this thing, people don't seem, they're maybe not even looking at the same thing, which makes it hard to go to the research and just go, yeah, this one saw that failure was better. And you're like, what was their failure versus this one over here that actually said failure was worse? You know, it was difficult. But again, like, in the context of people in the, you know, if you haven't experienced failure, how can you tell someone to go to failure? You know, I'm told my client, who, this is just hypothetical, let's say you're an online personal trainer. Client comes in, you write them a program, and it says, take everything to failure. And this person, it's the first time they've ever followed the program like that. What will that mean to them? That might mean that they stop when it starts getting a bit hard, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you see a video and you're like, why, you know, they send you a video and you're like, well, that's not failure, you got six more. They might not know that. For them, that might be the hardest they've ever pushed themselves, and that also might be enough.
Also, there's like a different, that I've always found this quite hard to explain, but when I used to run in the winter, when you weren't like speed fit, and you might do like, I don't know, six, let's say you're doing like 200 meters, and you'd be finding that, and you would be running as hard as you could for those 200 meter sprints. But in the summer, when you're speed fit, if you were asked to do 200 meters, you wouldn't finish. Like, there's no way, because you can push yourself that bit more and you're faster, but your effort level is the same. Like, it's really weird. And I think that sometimes that's the same with like in being in the gym as well, that actually, you know, you physically couldn't push more because it's not even really the fitness, it's like,
well, there's still the other factors that go into it, because failure, being able, and this is where we should even define failure, is how would you define failure? Because from a, you know, perspective of bringing mechanics into the conversation, failure in the way that we normally see it is literally the point, you get to a point in a set where your muscles will fail in their ability to generate enough force or torque to overcome the resistance. That doesn't mean that muscles failed, in the sense of, if you just adjusted the resistance, chances are they could keep going, which we see. So it's the thing of, someone's like, I went to failure. And then if you're in a personal training scenario, someone's on a leg extension and they hit that last rep, and then you go in and you just lighten the load a little bit in the system, and like, oh, I can keep going. So they didn't reach failure, but they got to the point where they just couldn't continue doing what they were doing before. So, but then, you know, in doing that, this was one of the things of people will have really struggled with in lockdown. You know, when you go, you know what train to failure is in a gym that you're familiar with, you go to do that thing. You know, when you go to the gym, there's a bunch of psychological, psychosocial, you know, contextual cues that make it quite easy for your nervous system to be like, I know what's expected of me here. This is the place where I lift stuff up and down and I push myself really hard. And then you put people in their living rooms where they chill out or they eat food and do stuff, and you're like, go to failure. And then, you know, on that subconscious level, their body's going to be like, no, like, this is, that's the sofa that I chill out on. Now you're telling me to hip thrust off it. Failure. That's going to be weird. So people might have struggled to get into the whole training mindset at home.
Yeah. That failure, that's a really interesting point, because I suppose it had occurred to me, but then when I had a little flick through the systematic review and meta-analysis, the Schoenfield one, the most recent one, which I'm sure you guys are familiar with. If any of the listeners aren't, go have a look at that one. But actually, I was just like having a quick little skim to see if there was like a standardized definition of failure on that. But out of all of the studies they use, it doesn't seem to be, not unless just from my skimming, I can't see that, but there's just not a standardized what failure is on that. So even when they're doing reviews and meta-analyses.
Yeah, that's the problem with meta-analyses in general, is a lot of the time meta-analyses are looked at as the gold standard, but in that you are still subject to the
there's still the deviations in methodology.
We've interpreted all these studies, like, have you interpreted it fully? You know, there's one of the best papers I've read, reviews, was one, it was I've got it on my Dropbox here. You'll love this, Emma. It was by a guy called Ralph Carpinelli, who's easily one of the coolest. He'd done some research, but, you know, coolest authors and researchers in the realm of hypertrophy I've ever come across, because he actually seems to factor in stuff around mechanics, which is cool. But he did one which was like a 30-odd page thing of a critical commentary on the stimulus for muscle hypertrophy in experienced trainees. And it's very entertaining, it's very in-depth, but there's a whole section where he literally goes, there's a massive problem because set endpoints haven't been defined properly in research. That was actually what first turned me onto that. So I was like, oh yeah, they haven't agreed on what the definition of failure is, so they're all looking at different things. But his is quite entertaining, because he basically just...
When's that one from?
That was in 2020.
Are you familiar with this one? Because this one's 22.
I was going to say, you might enjoy it, because he basically just spends most of it taking some very funny jabs at Brad Schoenfeld's research.
Oh, really? Yeah, because this one is the effects of resistance training performance repetition failure on non-failure on muscular strength and hypertrophy, a systematic review and meta-analysis.
Who was that one?
That's the, I can't pronounce the first name on that, but that's got Schoenfeld in it. It's GRGIC. Jozo, GIGIC. Grigic. Brad Schoenfeld.
But I mean, that's the thing.
Where are the vowels?
if you look at most of the research, all these papers, you'll tend to find the same conclusion, which is, and this is a shock because I'm not sure if I've read that one, but I may have, that they go, train to failure and not train to failure seem to be equally effective.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, that is it.
That's that thing of like, it's not, you know, necessary, it just seems sufficient.
I think is more like interesting about this whole discussion is, and what's really useful for people and hopefully encouraging to people, is if you really don't have a lot of time or you don't like training, but you want to get the benefits of resistance training, if you understand that resistance training is beneficial to your health, but you don't really want to do that much of it, or you're short on time, or, you know, various reasons, then you can do very little in terms of time commitment if you push yourself to failure. Like, I think Keith Barr's work is really interesting on this, where he did, I think, I can't remember if it was one or two sets now. It might have just been one set. I'm pretty sure it was. But anyway, it was one set to failure on numerous machines. And it was like the strength increases were the same as three sets to failure. Mm. And obviously the time commitment is like a third of that.
Mm.
And if, yeah, I just think that for a lot of people, especially when people are trying to get into the gym, or even, I guess, like some of my clients who maybe have this optimal level where, yeah, they can spend an hour in the gym, but then there's always the mindset of, well, if I can't go for an hour, there's no point going at all. And really, like, I think exercise for most people falls under that like 80-20 principle, where actually you're probably getting 80% of the benefit from 20% of the work that you do. Like, if you go into the gym and actually maybe like the first set of each exercise that you do is probably the one that's giving you the biggest benefit. I'm not saying that the others don't give you any benefit, but there is this law of diminishing returns. And when you really understand that, it's so much more encouraging to go to the gym, even if you only have 20 minutes, or to do a little home workout, or to do something as opposed to doing nothing, because you really see that the biggest bang for your buck is that first bit of exercise that you're doing.
Yeah.
It reinforces that something is always better than nothing.
Yeah.
No matter what time you have.
But then equally, if someone's like, oh, but I really dislike going to failure, again, you could still go and do 20 minutes and not go to failure. You'll still probably get a lot out of it.
So
if you were wanting to be supremely jacked, that's a different story. But from just being like, I want to improve my health, get a bit stronger, maybe I won't go to failure, but I'll still do some stuff where I push it failure.
So that would be my question, is if you don't like being at failure, I don't like being at failure, what can you achieve without it? What are the limitations if you don't want, like, if you're not very good at failure?
So assuming you've got no time constraints, then you don't have to go to failure at all. On the same thing here, and this is, you know, appreciating that the concept of training to failure isn't distinct from, it doesn't exist separately from like the RPE scale, so rate of perceived exertion and reps in reserve. Like, some people treat them as completely different things. Like, either you're the RIR or in the RPE crowd, or you're trained to failure. They're all on the same spectrum. The training to failure group just sit right at the end. We only do this one part of the spectrum.
Mike, I feel like you're cherry picking info to take back to Aaron, really. I don't feel like this is genuine curiosity. I feel like you're fishing for ammo here.
I'm not going to lie. Like, I think that we do a fair mix of, you know, obviously we don't just train to failure, and we only tend to do training to failure under sort of certain circumstances, like kind of smaller muscle groups and ones not requiring lots of recovery before the next session and all that sort of stuff, as far as I understand it, not that I understand it fully.
And I imagine safety of the exercise, in the sense of, if you were going to go, let's go to absolute failure on a barbell back squat, that's a big risk.
Yeah.
Versus saying, we'll go to failure on a leg extension where you're sitting in a machine and joints.
No, like more like tricep stuff and pressy things.
Yeah, so that's part of the conversation on that.
So like, I'm not getting out of it, am I?
What, training to failure?
Yeah.
Well, you, I mean, this is where you can go through it at different points. I think that's one of the freedoms we have as exercise professionals, as well as saying, I don't have to do this thing, I don't have to commit to even saying, okay, I'll do failure just on these exercises and I'll do not failure on these ones, you know. And again, you know, I think we should just say, you know, I don't think failure is an appropriate term, because like we've discussed, you can't necessarily ever take a muscle to failure. Like, there's such a thing as like the strength deficit I don't know if you've ever seen where research where they've tested voluntary muscle activation and then involuntary, where they basically like cattle prod someone. And there's always more that we have available that we can't control because the body, you know, got to do stuff hopefully after we're done training. It's not going to give you 100% of a muscle. So you're never really going to reach failure anyway. You're kind of getting to that point where you're just like, I just can't do this exercise. But being able to like adapt that as we go. And that's one of the benefits of in person. And I think you can still do it online. I do it with my clients. It's just giving them more guidelines. And as they get more experienced, it becomes in the same way intuitive eating becomes more of an option than nutrition. You know, people can, or not tracking, let's say, you know, people can get to a point where they go in and they go, oh, actually, no, I haven't slept well. I'm dealing with a lot of stress. I'm actually not feeling it that much today. But my program says I've got to go to failure. Fuck. Whereas they could go in and go, taking into account all those factors that I know are going to influence how well I can get to failure today, quote unquote failure, today I won't. And if you're, you know, that's where if you're a PT, you should probably ask the client more than just, are you ready to get started at the beginning of the session? Ask them how their day's been. Have they just been in a car crash before they got there? Have they had a really stressful day at work? Because if you've got this plan in your head that like, today we're going to smash them up on the leg press and take them all the way to failure, but they've had a really, really stressful time and there's a bunch of stuff that's happened to them that means by the time they've got to you at the gym, their nervous system is in such a state that failure is going to be unrealistic and inappropriate. Maybe it's off the table and you have to look at what you're doing. So it isn't like a thing we have to do. And again, if you're like, but I usually go to failure on the leg extension, you don't always have to, you know.
And I think if you go into, for example, I normally do 3 sets of pull-ups in the morning, but if I went to absolute failure in my first set, there's no way I'd get as many reps total. So I normally go for like 2 reps in reserve or something. We know that volume is important for hypertrophy, and how most people, from my understanding, and Luke correct me if I'm wrong, kind of get the best of both here, is that like you would never go to failure like on your first exercise in the gym. Like you would be creating some volume, and then maybe on you do like a drop set, or you know, you'd go to failure on some exercises but not others, and maybe on your last set but certainly not your first set, unless you didn't care at all about the volume of work that you were doing, unless you were doing it for more like the minimal effective dose, like how quick can I be in and out of the gym and have some kind of positive impact, versus I want to build a lot of muscle, I know I need to create some volume here. It would be stupid to go to failure at the start of my session because I'm going to be so fatigued after that I won't be able to create as much volume.
I agree. The it's the volume side of things comes like, I mean, the Chris Beardsley, I don't know if you've looked at some of his stuff. Yeah, he's actually, you know, because ultimately what we're trying to do when we take someone to failure is, you know, go, I want to create enough fatigue within the muscle that they recruit enough of their kind of, you know, larger motor unit. So we're aiming for that full spectrum motor unit recruitment. We want to get to a point where things involuntarily slow down in terms of how they're lifting that thing, because that leads to like a more optimal environment inside the muscle for generating all the triggers that, you know, start the hypertrophy signaling. And, you know, Chris Beardsley, you know, who's a guy who's got a lot of stuff in mechanics and exercise exercise physiology. You know, his take on it is we don't really ever need to go to failure. Potentially, because once you start using heavy enough loads, you're automatically moving that thing really slowly. So if getting to failure is this thing you do to try and get it to slow down and get that optimal force, you know, cross bridging within the muscle muscle fibers, you know, you don't even need to go there. And you can take more of that volume based approach and just look for that sort of, you know, approach, that sort of the markers of, is my client or am I getting to a point where things are slowing down and it's getting really hard, and cool, we've done that for 2 or 3 reps in this set, now let's stop and leave it there. We don't need to go to the point where the bar falls on them. You know, again, that comes down to when you talk about failure, you know, when someone's talking about failure, if they understand the processes that they're trying to stimulate physiologically, you also understand that you don't even need failure to get that. So it's, yeah. I don't know if that was exactly in line with what you were saying, but...
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I guess my point is you can get the best of both. Like, you certainly would do it all the time.
Yeah.
And you can kind of create volume, and you wouldn't be doing reps to failure on every exercise.
Yeah. And it, you know, even in the extreme, you know, failure crowd, they don't train to failure all the time. You know, it's usually a time and a place thing. And again, you know, I think the most important thing is that we're aware, you know, if we're asking ourselves or other people to do it, that we're doing it, like you said at the beginning, safely, you know. And that's where, you know, again, bringing it back to the mechanics side of things, that there's a lot of stuff that's said around training to failure is inherently more risky for, like, injuries. You know, you'll potentially get injured more if you train to failure. And I think that's incorrect, because the context in which that's been studied is in research, where they will say everyone did the same range of motion. You know, we looked at failure on a barbell bench press, and we looked at failure on a barbell back squat or a leg press, and everyone did the same thing. You know, they touched the bar to their chest, they did the thing. And in some people, as we've seen, maybe not here, but as like, I say we, as I'm talking about the collective, maybe looked into the mechanics side of things, touching a bar to your chest in the context of a bench press can lead to vastly different realities in terms of what's happening within the joint. So for some people, they're built in such a way where they have so much mass on their chest and their rib cage is so thick, and they've got quite short forearms. Again, it's similar to that squat thing, that touching the bar to their chest is pretty easy, like, doesn't really lead to much compromise in the joint. And then you get these other people with these really, you know, shallow rib cages, really long arms, and touching the bar to their chest is like this, it requires all this crazy internal rotation or external rotation and like maneuvering in the shoulder joint, and also taking the muscle into a much more extreme length relatively. So for them, it might be pretty risky, but for the other people, it's not. And so the point there is, if you can still train people to failure, and as long as you, the exercise professional, are aware of what's a safe range for them to work in based on how they're built and what they can control, you probably might, you know, I wouldn't think you would suffer any extra risk, because most of the time we suffer injuries because we've exceeded force tolerance. And if we're making sure that we're, you know, force tolerance in the tissue, that is, so we've taken the point tissue to a point where it's like, I can't generate force here and I'm in a really compromised length and extreme position, we can still take someone into those positions depending on the exercise. But if it's a position we know they can control because we've assessed that relative to them, I don't think the injury risk goes up. And I've seen that anecdotally, but I know the research disagrees.
Yeah, I guess that's poor personal trainer or poor researcher who hasn't adapted the exercise to the individual.
That's one of the things, research in the whole area of hypertrophy and all that sort of stuff, and particularly training to failure, would be far more useful and fascinating if they published videos of the participants performing the exercises with it, so we could see, what did failure actually look like here? Also, what does this exercise look like for this individual, you know, the participant number one versus participant number eight? Because it looks like when they plotted those two on this graph, they had wildly different results. So I kind of want to see what.
Also, I'd just like to say, like, research papers look so boring and they present the data so poorly. Like, why are we still looking at Western blots? Like, surely there's a better way to present that than, like, looking at, like, a tiny little thing on a piece of, like, there must be a better way. And even, like, the graphs, I'm like, give these
people... Are you telling me that manovers and standard deviations aren't easy to understand?
I think they should send out...
They could just make it, like, you know, because then it gets reinterpreted by someone into a Facebook post or an Instagram post and actually looks, like, quite understandable, quite good. But why can't they do that with research? It's meant to be translatable, right? There's no point. I think this is, like, one of my big bugbears about, like, science research in general, is so much of it isn't translatable. And I get that there's people who kind of straddle both worlds and, like, do make that research translatable, but that should be the job of the researcher as well, to make that. There's no point writing all this stuff that no one understands except your peer group. Like, it should be translatable.
One of my favorite things to say, because I've had conversations with people where they go, oh, but this research paper said this, so I think this is the best thing that we should be doing. You know, this is the best thing for my client, whatever it is. And I'll be like, well, was your client in that study? And he's like, yeah, they'll be like, no, they weren't. I'm like, well, how do you know that the client, your client, will respond the same way that those 23 participants would? Because all we've got in that scenario is an average of 23 people, you know, in this paper. And that average, we're now going to generalize to everyone. And that's one of the things I like about those research papers, is looking at the individual results. When they look at a group of, like, we assessed 23 people. These were the, you know, two different groups. Here's this group, here's this group. We can look at the general, or you can look at the graphs, and you can see, like, the random genetic outliers clearly, where it's like, well, this guy exploded in 12 weeks, and then these guys actually lost muscle in this condition, but they apparently all did the same thing. And all that, like that's one of the things I like about research in general, is it doesn't tell us, it tells us more about how individual we are and how generic we can be with kind of the advice we give people, I think. Because when you look at, like you say, the individuals who and their responses within training, you come to the conclusion, like, wow, people are very different on a physiological, genetic level, clearly. And that's actually pretty fascinating. So it means when we do all this stuff with our clients, you shouldn't really ever do it with a massive degree of certainty. Like, if you're an online coach out there saying, when we do this exercise after 8 weeks, you are definitely going to have a bigger, like, you know, bigger chest or bigger glutes, whatever it is, I wouldn't be that certain. Oh,
like, if you've worked with more than 10 clients, you'll realize that some people respond extremely different to exercise than other people do. And this is why I find it kind of funny when it happens less so now, but there used to be this real push that I am only an evidence-based personal trainer. And I'm like, if you only look at evidence and base everything off evidence, you are missing a huge amount. Because, like you're saying, it's all averages. And the likelihood is you're an evidence-based personal trainer who's not actually been taught to read research and to critique research, because that's really hard to do, especially if it's out with your very, probably very specific niche. Of, like, I couldn't critique papers that aren't in my area of knowledge, which is quite small. So yeah, like, I think being a little bit more open-minded and realizing the limitations of research and realizing that it's really good to guide you, but you shouldn't be assuming that everyone will respond in the same way that this research paper says they've responded. And there's pros and cons to, like, larger research, but again, then you're looking at the average of a larger group of people, but still, like, who is the average person?
But also, people forget that, like, anecdotal evidence is still evidence. Like, evidence doesn't just come from research papers. It might not be as powerful as research papers, but you can't ignore anecdotal evidence entirely. Like, there is some benefit to it, and it has some validity too.
Yeah. I mean, I've had loads of instances of that where I've gone, because my approach, I when we had our education course with the Muscle Mentors, there was a presentation where I talked about being a skeptical scientist with what we're doing as exercise professionals, which is basically coming up with a hypothesis based on a bunch of information that you've, you know, accrued over the years, and, you know, running that hypothesis and then seeing what happens, you know, like, and treating it in that way. So, you know, whether you have a consultation with a client or you assess a client, you just got a bunch of data, and then hopefully you from that can go, okay, I think I know the way to get you to this goal, whether it's growing a body part, getting stronger, whatever it is. I'm going to come up with this hypothesis. And, like, well, I've come up with this hypothesis. Now here's the experiment, like the conditions. Let's run the experiment. And the conditions might be, here's a training program. We're going to run it for 12, 16 weeks, and we're going to see what happens. And we're going to assess stuff as we go. And at the end of that, we're going to see if it was a success. Yeah. And sometimes you'll get to the end of that and you'll go, I wasn't a success. Maybe you didn't measure enough things in terms of, there's a lot of coaches out there that might, you know, not track certain things that they could track in terms of circumference measurements, whatever it is. They might not give it long enough. But, you know, if we treat it with that sort of approach, it's and you can be that blunt with clients, but not being so uncertain that it creates uncertainty with them. Kind of just being realistic and being like, this is probably a pretty good shout. Let's go with this. But, you know, there's a chance we might have to readjust our faith down the line.
I think there's context for that as well, anecdotally, whether that is anecdotally based on a fitness professional that has, you know, experience working with hundreds of people and has had to run those hypotheses, or that is influencer-based, that this has worked for me, so this would definitely work for you. Yeah. There's a difference there as well, I think, within that.
Yeah, and you could theoretically do both, but obviously the evidence behind one hypothesis might be stronger. But having that sort of, you know, the ability to do that will, you know, you potentially run into less issues when, you know, if things do require changing or you encounter that client where you're like, they seem to be an outlier, it doesn't seem to be working at all, even though everything that I know tells me it should. You know, and that can be quite a and you know, you could have that approach and not tell the client that that's what you do in terms of
I think being quite confident and like sure in your messaging is so important to the client, like especially with things like nutrition. If you kind of give advice, if I gave the same advice as someone else but I said it like, oh, this may or may not work, like there's some evidence for it but some evidence doesn't work and sometimes it does work, sometimes what are the chances that someone's actually going to stick to that is so much lower than someone who's like, this will work, stick to it, go. If anything, like, you know, obviously if it doesn't, then we'll change things, but you come to that down the line,
that's where
they're much more likely to get results just from the fact that adherence will be 50% higher.
Yeah, and that's where we can use the power of suggestion to our advantage. No, there's certain situations. So I say that I've had clients where, you know, it pays to be, you know, give them that much transparency and just say, listen, we've tried a bunch of stuff, or you've tried a bunch of stuff up until this point. We're going to run a slightly different thing here. You know, I'm confident it's going to work. But, you know, if we have to, I would never say, I don't think it's not going to work, but I might say we might readjust some stuff based on how the data turns out as we go. But yeah, there will be other clients where it will be very much this is going to work.
Yeah.
And also times where I'm that confident in the hypothesis anyway. I'm like, I see, you know, it's still a hypothesis, but I might be kind of like, actually, I'm very certain that this is going to pan out in terms of this person is going to grow this body part, or they're going to hit that number on whatever, you know, strength target on whatever lift it will be, whatever it is. You know, there are cases where that would be, and I agree, I think being a confident professional is obviously a key part of it.
Yeah, well, no one can have confidence in you, right? Do we want to wrap this up for today and key take home points? Anyone? Mike, going to failure?
I think I have to carry on going a bit to failure.
A little bit.
But then selective failure.
Maybe examine why you find it so hard.
I think it's that nervous system thing that you talk about. Like, I've always had a bad day.
That can't be true. Level Up was a lovely day.
Level Up was a lovely day.
But that would be, you should make that might be an interesting thing, and maybe it's exercise specifically, but actually it's this exercise. I hate going.
No, do you know, like, I have reflected on this quite a lot, and actually I think part of the issue is I'm quite used to going to failure in certain aspects of life, like I've spoken about this before, like I've been able to study endless hours because I need to do that to pass an exam. So like I can go to mental failure quite easily, but I think because I spent the first several decades of my life never considering like physical failure to be like an important thing, it's such an alien concept to me. Like I find it in running, I find it in HIIT training, I find it in weight training, like physical failure, I just seem to have a natural tendency to want to avoid it at all costs.
Like, but so this would come back to what, and I know we're wrapping up here, so I'll keep this brief. What's the, you know, what's the goal with your training? Because if the goal isn't, I want to get my triceps supremely jacked, you probably don't need to even go to failure. You can still go to a point where it's like, it's getting hard now, I might stop. And it's, you know, it's getting, I'm probably two reps away from failure. But if the goal isn't to have supremely jacked triceps, you don't necessarily need to do it.
I know, but I think like significant improvement is very important to me as a general like quality and life value. So I don't really like it's one of the, I don't like half-assing it.
Yeah, but like when you talk about that, if you're like, I want significant improvement, like my favorite quote for this is, you can't get upset about the results you didn't get from the work that you didn't
100%.
Do.
100%. No, that's my point. I'm not upset about it. I'm upset,
fine, because you're only, but like, if you're like, this is what I really want, then it does require that. And
yeah,
it does.
No, yeah, exactly.
To an extent, like there are people who like pushing themselves like that. Like athletes enjoy it. They get a buzz out of it. But like, it's the same with a lot of things. It's like when people are like, oh yeah, I would diet, but I really like food. Everyone really likes food. Even people that are really good at dieting really like food as well. And I think like when people are like, oh, you know, exercise seems like quite hard. It is. Like a lot of these things are hard and some people enjoy them some of the time. But I think it's unrealistic to expect that you'll always enjoy them or that it won't require like an element, if not a huge chunk of hard work.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that's my point, is that in some ways, maybe I don't need to push myself as much as I think I need to. But it's more getting your head around, not like, I think it's more that you want to, like, I like being good at stuff. Like actually not being like being rubbish at things isn't very nice either. So actually in some ways, you're choosing which discomfort is more valuable to you, I suppose, at the end of the day.
Is the pain of staying where you are worse than the pain of change? Is that what you're saying?
Emma has memorized all of the quotes and I love this.
But for the record, I should add, I don't think I've said, I train to failure mostly. I enjoy it. I enjoy going into the gym and being like, I've left everything there, you know, in terms of I couldn't have given more to that. There are certain exercises where I know if I go to failure, it actually causes discomfort in a bad way. But the point where I kind of, maybe I misinterpreted, where you said you don't, you know, if you didn't go to failure, you kind of wouldn't be pushing in the direction you want to push.
No, I don't mean, what I mean is that, like, so for example, you're saying that for my, like, if you don't need to be supremely jacked or whatever, like you just want to feel a bit better, like, you know, train for health and all of that sort of stuff. That is true, but also I feel like I want to do my best. Like I want, and I think if I don't push myself a little bit, that's not my best. Like I feel like I get frustrated that I'm capable of more, but that I can't be bothered.
Okay. So yeah, so that is interesting. So, but then that might be, yeah, again, we could go down this forever, can't we?
I know. Emma's left. Like
I would say you could do more sets. And
not going to bed. No, a lot of our episodes tend to be turning into like self-therapy sessions for me recently.
Yeah. This is being pedantic, by the way, and I know Dan's feeling that. I'm literally just thinking, what for the coaches out there, what other questions could you ask your clients when they say, I'm really struggling with failure, or you know, they don't necessarily enjoy it? What other ways could you get them to that goal without going to failure? That's basically all I'm considering. But anyway, we could go on. I know we've done a 10-minute wrap-up now.
Yeah, so I guess, Dan, any take-home points?
Don't leave your mic on mute. Train to failure or don't train to failure. It is up to you. No, I think the take-home for most people is that it's, you know, if a lot of people are warned off of exercise or don't warm to exercise because they're worried that they can't push themselves to a certain point or that they don't really want to. We speak a lot about time, but I also think there's time and inclination is something to think about, because it might be that people do genuinely have time, but at the end of when it gets to 8 p.m., they don't really want to. And then having the message hammered home that you have got time, you just don't want it enough, isn't helping anyone.
That's not motivating.
Isn't helping
anyone. Shaming people into exercise because they'd rather watch TV. That's not motivating. What?
But actually wrapping your mind around something is always better than nothing. And regardless of aesthetic aspirations or body composition goals, there are a bunch of health benefits to be had from just engaging in any kind of physical activity. If we're talking about reducing the risk of cardiovascular disease, reducing the risk of type 2 diabetes, the mental health benefits, there's so much more to be had out of physical activity that we don't often give credit to. It's not just body composition and aesthetic based.
Yeah.
And I think that you can get really, really good results from not doing it perfectly, but doing it consistently and showing up consistently and not going through these bouts of, I'm going to train every single day and then I'm not going to train at all. If I can't go every day, there's no point going. Or if I can't go to the full 1 hour gym session, there's no point doing anything. And I think like I am living proof of this because my training's dropped massively, but I still consider like I will always go to the gym at least 3 times a week. But compared to what I used to do, it's like barely anything. And I certainly don't push myself anywhere near as hard. And yeah, probably not in as good a shape, but compared to general population, I'm still in pretty decent shape. And I think like that realization to people that it, you don't actually need to do these incredible things. And I will add to this that I think maintaining what you have is ridiculously easier than building. So I'm not going to say like, Just train 3 times a week and not even that hard and you'll be able to do this, this, and this. Like, I think a lot of that is that, you know, I've spent years building muscle. But yeah, that is a message I want to hammer home to people, is that like you don't need to do as much as you think.
Yeah, I think that's behavior change in general as well, is that we tend to think quite grand. And this is why I think a lot of people fall into that all or nothing mindset. They think quite grandiose, like I need to totally overhaul my whole lifestyle. I need to change how I'm eating, change how I approach exercise. But it's the tiny, seemingly small, insignificant things that do actually tally up. It's the person that can't find an hour to go for a walk every day to do their best part of their 10,000 steps. Yeah, but okay, but what if you were to set a timer that every 2 hours you took a 5-minute break away from your desk? You know, that time accumulates. What if you park a bit further away when you go to the supermarket? What if instead of worrying about having 2 litres of water a day, it's just you make sure there is a bottle of water waiting for you when you wake up in the morning? You know, all of these tiny little things, they're the ones that tally up over time. But people tend to go in with this attitude, right, I need to just stop eating chocolate. I need to stop drinking alcohol. I need to go to the gym 5 times a week instead of...
And track failure every time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think, yeah, it's it can be as hard or as difficult as you want to make it. There is definitely compromises for everyone, but... It doesn't mean totally overhauling your life and making it as difficult as possible.
Yeah. May I say one final thing?
Yes.
Absolutely.
This will be half an hour, so tune in. The thing that we haven't necessarily gone into, which I don't know, we could go into in the future if you ever want me back, would be how people apply this. So I know we talked about like the benefits, drawbacks and stuff like that. If you're a coach and a PT, like there's ways you can use failure and you need to be quite specific about it. Like we've discussed some of them, but also just down to, you know, whereas people say go to failure on everything, you need to be specific about the exercises you tell people to go to failure on and understand how many joints are involved here. What's the demand on getting, you know, someone having to kind of coordinate a load of different things here, and is it safe to get this person to go?
What's
to
the risk reward ratio to this?
Yeah, and like, you know, whether you use failure as the set end point, or whether you use an RPE scale or an RAR scale, you're always going to have to work someone up to that. So you don't ever expect, you know, basically have an approach, you know, which, and that might look different with a bunch of people and it will look different depending on the client, but have an approach that might scale someone up to being able to go, now they can go to failure. Where we've kind of ticked enough boxes, they've demonstrated enough control, coordination, strength, etc. I'm confident that this is now appropriate. And the same if you say to someone, I need you to relieve 3 reps in reserve, and they've never been to failure, that requires them to know what no reps in reserve is. So having that appreciation is like the next part of that conversation, and maybe one that people can ponder. It's like, oh yeah, what would failure be like on a split squat versus a leg extension? Pretty decent quad exercises, different demands, probably very separate in terms of how you'd tell someone to go to failure or how failure would look, maybe. That's what I'd say.
Awesome. Cool. All right. Thank you so much for your time and your time.
Thank you for having me.
Where can people find you on El Interneto?
At the moment, the only places. So the YouTube channel that was previously associated with the Muscle Mentors has now been renamed Luke Hoffman. So I'm going to be putting a bunch of stuff on there around exercise mechanics in an easily digestible, applicable format. So hopefully people will enjoy that stuff. And then at the moment, and if people have any questions, until I get the website up and running and stuff like that, I'm just Luke David Hoffman on Instagram.
Cool.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Bye.
Bye. Bye.